and a prominent civic leader for the past six decades. Listen to their past and yours.
Okay. Good afternoon to all my friends here, and particularly my relatives that I have quite a few of here. When Pat first asked me to do this presentation, I thought, well, you know, that's not much of a problem. Then I began to think that what he was requesting, I'm going to try to condense into 15 minutes 70 and 80 years ago in my remembrances, which is, I'm not sure we're going to go through with it. But to start with, the family moved here in 1928 from Burlington. We lived in a number of homes on Center Street and then Madison and another home on Madison. From there, we moved to Maxwell Street, and if you were coming from Elkhorn, this is how we described where we lived. You came on Highway 12 until you hit the stockyards. Then you turned right and went down through the city dump. And when you got up a block and a half, you were at the cemetery, and that's where we lived. Now, you have to remember that this was the year of 1930s and the 40s, which was in the midst of the Depression and the beginning and end of World War II. So a lot of the things were completely different than you would have expected prior to that time. When I mentioned the hobo jungle, this was during the Depression, and these men, mostly younger men, would come up from Chicago on the train, and it was a cardboard shack, and these people would spring and summer and fall at the end of Maxwell Street and would come along and beg. And if the housewife was a giver of some food, there was a mark out on the street, and so the next man would know which house to stop at. And this continued way up until the middle of the Depression, when the Civil Conservation Corps came in and started taking young men to provide jobs, and Works Progress Association or administration started building the post office, the Riviera, that type of public works. So that's a little of the background. Now, I thought I might put things in as far as the household living would be concerned. The first item on that would have been the food preparation. At that time, to start with, we only had ice boxes. The ice was delivered by a delivery man, and the housewife would put in the window the number of pounds that she wanted in the ice box. When the ice finally went out and was replaced by refrigeration, it was very small units, and those were with a big unit set on the top, and it held very little food. And there were no food lockers available for any quantity of food. Therefore, the housewife, and in my case, most everybody I knew, did all kinds of canning. And most of you have not heard of canned meat, but that is the way we processed any of the amount of meat, quarters or halves or whatever, was purchased by canning the food, which was put down in a dark cellar in the basement. And this is where it was kept, along with the potatoes, all the canned vegetables, and, as I said, canned meat. And it was able to keep it cool enough and dark enough, but finally in the spring, all the potatoes would have sprouts on them. Some of the canned stuff would have spoiled. But that was the method of preserving food. Now, as far as grocery stores were concerned, at the time, all during the 30s and into the 40s, there were anywhere from 5 to 6 different grocery stores in Lake Geneva. The National T, the A&P, Kroger's were the main ones, but there were many small individual stores. Like Ruckty's had 2 stores. Later names were Gaskell, Johnny Jack's, Anderson's, Powers, and so forth. Then there was another grocery store on Walworth Street. All these little stores where people were trying to make a living during the war. There were also numerous dairies. There's Aspinall Dairy, Marindale Dairy, Maple Leaf Dairy were a number of those. The housewife at that time could call the grocery store, give them a list of the items that she wanted, and it would be delivered. sometimes by horse and later on by cars. That was the method, unless she wanted to walk down to the store. Very few women knew how to drive, and plus there weren't many automobiles around, and in the wintertime it was a real chore because the streets were hardly ever plowed more than one row down until it melted off. Now, another item that brings to mind is how the homes were heated and or cooled. The original method was either a potbelly stove. From there on, we went to furnaces, and the furnaces were fueled by shoveling coal in whenever needed. And that went on for a long time. The delivery man would bring the coal in, a chute down into the basement to the coal cellar, and then into the furnace. Then the big innovation that came along was the stoker. And the stoker was a big hopper with an auger that went into a fire pot within the furnace, and you could fill that out, and by thermostat, it would start to run the coal in and keep the house warm. The only problem with that is the residue was a huge clinker, and all those clinkers had to be taken out every morning and put outside. Most of them were, you would let cool because they were so hot. And that was the next method was, and we finally got gas in, and then eventually natural gas, which we have now. Along with the heating and cooling, and there was no cooling, on the very hot days, most everybody slept in the basements. That was the only cool spot in the home. Hot water was at a premium. In the furnace that we had in our home, there were some coils that ran inside the furnace, and during the heating season, you had enough water for maybe a couple washings, for instance. Other than that, we had to always heat the water with a little gas burner that would heat whatever size pail that you put on it. Laundry was another major problem in that the method of washing, we had two tubs. We did have a wash machine with an agitator on it, but the wringer was hand-wrung. It wasn't mechanized enough to roll through like most wringers are now. Everything had to be iron, and if that type of material, plus all the drying was done outside on clotheslines or in the wintertime in the basement hung on lines there. Then the big invention that came in was the mangle. And if you've never seen a mangle, the museum has one where the big roller, and you got pretty talented at being able to fold everything to run through this mangle. All right, continuing. Now, the home life as a child on Maxwell Street, I'm going up to the age of, let's say, 10 or 12, consisted of doing all kinds of chores. Everybody had a garden that I know of in our neighborhood, and that was a method of producing food and so forth. And as Pat mentioned, some of them were large enough to sell in the commercial markets here in town. But those were all jobs that were assigned to myself and my fellow members. Now, as far as games were concerned that we played, I have a whole list of those. You maybe remember them. Ante-ante over, kick the can, hop, skip, and jump, hide and seek, touch football. In fact, that was so popular that I would come home from football practice as a freshman in high school in order to play touch football in the street under the streetlights. Marbles. Now, I've just mentioned this to Colleen, and she doesn't remember, but we had the national marble tournaments here down on Riviera Beach for a number of years. There were, I think, probably 6 to 8 clay courts that were laid out every summer, and marble experts, qualifiers, would come from all over the country. Bud Bailey, if you remember that name, a local man here, won a national championship down on the Riviera Beach. Now, most people don't remember this, but it was a very, very popular sport at the time. Bag swings. We had a bag swing down at the end of Wisconsin Street in what we call the jungle. All the apartment buildings on West Wisconsin Street was in woods and swamp down there. We had bag swings. There was was also another one on the lake shore up by Stone Manor that we had access to a tree with its bag swing, and we would swing way out over the water and then come back on. There were little or no restrictions on the lake shore. The path was there as it is now. Most of the states had their huge piers, and we were allowed to fish off of those. We also had gangs, not as you think of gangs now, but there was the Pleasant Street Gang, the Center Street Gang, the Dodge Street Gang. All of these were organized by ourselves to play mainly baseball. The baseball field that was most used is where the Anchor Church or the Emmanuel Lutheran Church was on Park Row. And whatever was built there was built by the kids ourselves. There was no adult participation in anything. If you wanted anything done, you did it yourselves. Downhill skiing and downhill sliding, the street on Pleasant Street, which was called Gerber's Hill, still is to this day, I believe, was the premier spot for sledding. And that continued all the way up until they came up with sanding on the road. In the 1950s, we tried to get the city to shut it off. They did for one day, and we had protests from drivers up above that they had to go around one block. And so the city continued to sand it. If you'll recall, down Campbell Street, there used to be a toboggan slide. That toboggan slide started way up there on Lakeshore Drive, went down, and then down onto the lake. And it was in operation for a number of years, city installed, and it continued until there was a number of injuries, and they stopped using it. The next toboggan slide was at the library, right alongside the Legion Canteen, and that continued for a number of years until injuries again. Then all the insurance people started getting in, and all those things went by the wayside. In the summers, most of the time, everybody met at the beach. That was the focal point when the weather was good, is to go down and swim. The original setup at the Riviera Beach, there's a break in the wall of the Riviera, and this beach extended out to there that you were able to step off those steps and onto the sand without getting your feet wet. That's how far the beach. We only have half of the original beach left there, and most of the time even less than that. But then the second pier was put in, and at that time the water was deep enough so that you had to be at least over 6 foot tall in order to be able to walk out there. Otherwise you had to swim. And at the end of that was a diving board, and that diving board was broke at least every other week, mostly by the Brueger family. They were absolutely some of the best divers at that time I've ever seen, and they were all pretty good-sized men. The lifeguard station was steps going up to a platform at the end of the first pier, the longer pier. And continuing. How many minutes have I got left? All right. Entertainment in the homes. We're not going to get through very much here, but the radio was the most popular thing at the time, and that radio was always hooked to an antenna, and most of the time the antenna ran all the way out of the house, all the way across your yard in order to pick up any reception. The programs for children at the time were the serials, Jack Armstrong, The Shadow, Orphan Annie, Tom Mix, and others. For the adults, Jack Benny, Amos and Andy, women's soap operas, there were many of those. And we also had record players. We also had many dice games, Monopoly, card playing. Rector set was another big item, which the logo or Legos have now replaced. As far as employment is concerned, when you got to 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, paper routes were the norm. In fact, I actually worked for Clyde's brother Earl, who was my same age, but he was a real businessman, and took over the paper routes, and we had to work through him, and he got a cut on everything that we delivered. And if you were lucky if you made 25 to 50 cents a week delivering papers. And if you weren't a real good bill collector, you didn't even make that because people would not pay you. Pardon? All right. Well, I could tell you stories about Earl. All right, just briefly, with only a few minutes left, I started school when we lived on Madison Street at the Third Ward School, which is now the Legion Hall, and that was K through 3. And at that time, when we lived on Madison, the football field for the local high school was right up there at by Blackwood's Greenhouse, which is pretty much on the corner of Grant and Madison. From there, we went to school at Central, which is now Central. The old high school, and it was called the old high school, was in between that and what is now Denison. Subjects at the school during that period of time was arithmetic, vocal music, homemaking for the girls, spelling, history, penmanship, geography, manual arts, and band. Class size was generally from 20 to 30. Discipline, ruler across the hands, clip behind the head, paddle that was used on your butt, and it was all handled by the teachers. There was no reporting to the families or to the police or anybody else. They handled the discipline. Bullies on the playground were always there, but it was never a big deal. Mostly it was handled. That paddle was used in manual arts as a method of when the paddle was there and you wanted to go to the restroom, you picked up the paddle. That's how they handled that. But it was also used as the paddle, and I actually saw it being broken over the rear of one of the naughty boys. Now, dress codes during that period of time. The girls were always wearing skirts. They had to wear leggings, which most of them didn't like at all during the cold weather. I remember the type of shoe wear that was really in vogue was high cuts. And boy, you had to have high cuts as a boy. I didn't have them for a while, and I was expecting them for Christmas. And came down, and no high cuts under the tree. And Barb can remember this, I actually cried, only to find out they were hanging off the chandelier up above me. But those were the darndest things. Your feet were always wet, they pinched your toes, so you always had cold feet. As I said, the girls generally wore skirts and sweaters, the boys sweaters and there were gabardine and corduroy trousers. Corduroy was the main type of trousers before blue jeans came in. During the later years going into high school, I generally wore a sport coat with a turtleneck or a T-shirt, and most of the other boys did, or sweaters. Pretty much the dress code. The girls, again, in skirts, bobby socks, which was the big thing up during the war. Is that about it? Condensing all this, I could go on. We ought to have a rerun for the next 10 years, 30 years, and so forth. But thank you very much. Thank you all for coming.
I'm Jim McClure. You're listening to Community Matters on WGTD. And taking you through the Lake Geneva Historic Preservation Commission's meeting called Tales of Lake Geneva for the first time in 5 years, gathering some of the elder citizens of Lake Geneva to talk about the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Next up, Clyde Boutel, a member of the well-known Boutel family, whose grandfather, Daniel Boutel, was a veteran of the Civil War. Clyde was a star football and basketball player at Lake Geneva High in the 40s and 50s and a teacher at Lake Geneva and Badger High School.
I want to start by introducing my wife, Nancy, reintroducing her to some of you. On September 1st, I will celebrate the fact that she's put up with me for 59 years. So. And it's pretty obvious that Fritz and I were picked to be on this committee to help lower the average age of the group. Now, I don't know how old, I don't know how old they are, but they've been around longer than I have. And it's nice to be in a group where you're the youngest rather than the oldest at age 84. So, Lake Geneva, well, one thing that I just scribbled down so I wouldn't forget it is one thing I always remember is all of the technology that I've seen come and change. And the one thing I always like to remember is I pick up the phone and somebody says, number please, and that doesn't happen anymore. Beloit, or Lake Geneva, I keep thinking I'm living in Beloit, but I grew up in Lake Geneva. And Lake Geneva is a town of nicknames. And one of the nicknames is Squeaky. And I think she changed her name to Alexander in order to lose that name of Squeaky. And then my brother Maurice used to work for Grover Cull at the Murriendale farm. And he managed to roll a truck with Grover's grandson, Bill Bagnell, in the truck with him. Neither one were injured, but the truck didn't do too well. And there was a race driver in those days by the name of Barney Ofield. And he often crashed. And from that day forward, Maurice was no longer Maurice, but he was Barney. And then one of my closest friends was Baggy Douglas. We grew up in the same block. And Baggy's name came from his father, Harold Douglas, so that name lasted two generations. Harold was a partner in the Douglas and Dunn feed grain business. And of course, feed grain, you've got lots of bags. And so Harold became Baggy, and Harold had two sons, Jack, who never changed from Jack, and Donald, who became Baggy forever and until he died about 10 years ago. I could tell stories all day about Baggy, but you'll hear a few of them anyway. And then there was Crap Lichty. You probably aren't familiar with that, but he is the guy that owned the boat business before it became Gage Marine. And Crap was another second generation. It went to his oldest son, Jack, who graduated from Annapolis and then had a career in the Navy and then decided he wanted to do something different. So he resigned, went to medical school and practiced medicine in Florida. And then there was Weasel Pendergast, who lived in the same block that we did. And Weasel was the captain of the Dixie Sluggers, named after his father's business. And I remember their thing, they always talked about Dixie Gas, the power to pass. And then there was Hoot Hare, and Hoot was the captain of the Eagles. And this was a team, these two teams were, kids were 10 to 12 years old, and they battled, and I was on the Eagles, and Hoot's mother would come up with wonderful cookies to entice us to drive all over town. He lived at the far end of town from where I lived, but that was the enticement. You'd get some cookies if you showed up for practice. And then there was Garbage Gerber, who was the football coach here for a number of years. And then there was my brother Earl, who was Itzy, and I have no idea where that name came from. Maybe, And then there were two girls, Butch Bellingham. Her father was in the automobile business. I forget what car it was. Nash, okay. And then there was Pete Pendergast, Weasel's sister, also living in the same area as we were. Now, in the Depression years, some of the things I remember from our family is somehow we had to hook up either to the city sewer or water, and I was too young to really understand which. But what I do remember is that they dug that ditch from our house out to Warren Street by hand. My Grandpa Smith and my dad and two uncles dug that by hand. And that's the kind of thing that happened in the Depression days, because you didn't have the money to hire people to do it. And my mother, who was a terrific cook, had prepared a real good chicken dinner for them. And when they were eating, she asked, "Well, how is it?" And my uncle, I almost saw a murder occur. My uncle said, "You know, when we've worked as hard as we have, almost anything tastes good." Okay, then another thing from the Depression days was our old, I grew up in 1032 Wisconsin Street, and our old barn was falling apart, wooden barn, and so we tore it down. And my dad wanted to build a two-car garage and have an apartment upstairs. And the blocks were, it was made out of cement blocks with a little facing on the outside, so they looked decent. And those were made one at a time by hand. And my brothers weren't around, so my dad and I did most of those bricks. And then on the other side of the block that we lived in was a guy by the name of Dick Suter, who was a person that constructed some of the famous homes on the lakeshore, a very prominent builder in his day. And by the time I'm coming along, he was dead, but his widow, who was sort of an invalid, lived in the house in our block and had a big barn right behind it. And in that big barn, Dick had stored a bunch of really beautiful hardwood flooring. And that was part of my dad's mail route. And Mrs. Suter said, "If you could use any of that, you're welcome to it." And so that became part of the apartment upstairs. And another neighbor, two houses away, Roy Thompson, who was a very good carpenter, laid that floor for my dad. But anyway, that's some of the kinds of things that were being done in Depression days. Another thing was in the Geneva Theater, in order to attract business, they had a deal where they gave away small bicycles, two-wheel bicycles, and they were designed so they looked like motorcycles. And every time you went to the movie, you got a little ticket, which you could put in the pot, and there would be a drawing. I forget how many were given away, but it was four, five, six, something like that. And because of my dad's route, there were a number of customers that he had that would go to the movies occasionally, but didn't have any kids left, so they would give the tickets to him. And finally, on the very last drawing, his ticket was won, and so I ended up with a really classy-looking bike, and every kid in the neighborhood learned how to ride a two-wheel bicycle from that thing. And then, as Patrick mentioned, my dad was a letter carrier, and in those days, he had two full deliveries every day. And as you can imagine, many people didn't get any mail at all on the second delivery, and so occasionally he would use a bicycle because he could go a couple of blocks without any stops. And this was 5 days a week, no deliveries, especially during the war, on Saturday. And he developed a spur on his heel, and it was like jabbing into the flesh with every step, and so he favored that a lot, and in the process he ended up ruining his arch, and finally was forced to retire after 37 and a half years of delivering mail. And when he did that, the National Letter Carriers magazine had an article about him and figured that he had walked the equivalent of 6.5 times around the world. And one of the things that he did, because he had three kids in the service during World War II, he was very conscious to how important letters to families were. And so he would go down on Saturday and case all of his mail, and then he would pull out all of the letters to parents and spouses. Sweethearts could wait until Monday. But then he would deliver this mail in his car with gas, with his ration gas, and that was something that was very much appreciated by anybody that received one of those letters on Saturday. And then he served on the school board for, I don't know, 30-some years, and at one point, somebody wanted to have a younger person on the school board, so they decided the way to do it would be to have a write-in campaign and get on the phone and call people and get them to go out and vote to replace Fuller. And they made the mistake of calling Mrs. John Brueger. And Burley mentioned the Brueger family, and there were, I think, three or four of them that were in the service, and Mrs. Brueger lived just a half a block from where we lived. And she says, "You can be sure I'll make a lot of phone calls, but it won't be to get rid of Fuller." And so then, I forget the exact numbers. There never were very big turnouts for school board elections in those days, but turned out it was like 45 to 6 or something like that. And Fuller was always bothered by, "I wonder who those 6 are that don't like me." Well, another thing that was sort of depression-oriented was the fact that there weren't many rooms. There weren't many hotels or motels, and so a lot of the women would rent rooms, and my mother being one of them. And what would happen would, we had 3 bedrooms upstairs, and she'd put us all on the screened-in porch downstairs or in the basement so she could rent those rooms. And some of the women that rented rooms, they'd have 2 signs. One would be rooms for rent, and the second sign would be Gentiles only. And so that I was always very proud of my mother that she just had the one sign, rooms for rent. Well, then Patrick mentioned the Legion canteen. When Fuller had to resign from his job with the post office, Freeman Mann, who was very active in the Legion, got Fuller to agree to run the canteen. And the canteen made a lot of money in those days for the Legion. And the difference that I see now, but what's going on at the canteen, and in my day, or Fuller's day, actually I worked there because I was in a lot when I was in college. And we would have the 2 doors that face the lake open, and then doors on both sides. And on a busy weekend, like this weekend, there'd be 3 and 4 deep waiting to get served on. And we had myself and a bunch of other high school kids that would be working. And my dad decided that one thing that should be added was we should sell popcorn, because popcorn is very profitable, and that's what he would do. He'd sit back in a corner and keep that popcorn thing going. And then I remember we bought our pop from Sheridan Springs, and Jerry Ledger would be the one that would do the delivery. And I remember that Walter Ledger was, I think, chairman of the organization that handled the draft. And so here I am in college, and between my sophomore and junior years, and my number was about to come up, and I thought, I'm not worried. With all the pop we bought from Sheridan Springs, Walt is not going to call me. Wrong. So I ended up making a very serious decision. I could go into the Army, or I could go into the Marine Corps. And in either case, it was just a 2-year commitment. And I had my oldest brother, Everett, was a lieutenant in the Marine Corps and served on Iwo Jima. He had a tough duty. He was his job was the forward observer for the artillery. And then Earl, next brother, was not the next brother, but a brother, was in the Army, and he was in the Battle of the Bulge. And then Barney, who made a career out of the Army. He spent most of the time having a ball on the Galapagos Islands protecting the Panama Canal, and he enjoyed fishing and playing with the big turtles and all of that. And he later got combat involved in Korea. But anyway, in one conversation they had, Everett felt that he would rather have been on Iwo than in the Battle of the Bulge because of the cold. So anyway, then back to the canteen. Freeman Mann withheld some money from my dad's paycheck. And my dad spotted that instantly. And he wanted to know, what the hell is going on? How come there's money out of my paycheck? And it was for Social Security. And Freeman explained to him that it's the law. I have to do that. And Fuller was not happy about that at all. But later on, when those checks started coming, and he lived to be 82, so he got a lot of checks, he thought that Freeman man really did me a good favor. So I'm trying to get as much of the interesting stuff here as I can. But all three of my brothers worked for the city at the tennis court, running the tennis court. And people had to play or pay to play tennis, and I think it was like 10 cents an hour. Earl especially would have a medical school textbook as a prop. And so when the girls would come and they'd spot that medical school textbook, they'd figure, aha, here's going to be a future doctor. We've got to get to know him. And that was part of the pay, I think, for those three guys running the tennis course. They met a lot of out-of-town girls. Burley mentioned the three grocery stores, or two of them, the two Ruckties, Fred Ruckty and Al Ruckty, both had stores about a block away from here. And I never knew what the problem was between them, but it was unusual that two brothers would have stores less than a block away. And then the other one that I remember was Martin Bartles, right on the corner over here. And I remember his ad was, always busy, there's a reason. That was pretty neat. Milk delivery. Merriandale was our milk provider, and Art Cull was a very close friend of Barney's. And in fact, he used to stay at our home many nights during the winter because the roads would be bad and he couldn't get back home, so he stayed with us. But anyway, when they would deliver the milk, as I remember, it was always in glass quart bottles, and they'd bring it right into the house and put it into the refrigerator. And that was the kind of service that they had to do to get business and keep business. And when you look at the bottle, there'd be about this much at the top, which was cream. And with a good mixmaster or something, you could actually turn that into whipping cream. Then there was the Victory Gardens. I think he mentioned that. And I got to really hate crabgrass because there was no end to it, it seemed like. And then the Soapbox Derby. We get back to my friend Baggy Douglas. He and I decided to build a vehicle and enter it in the race. And the races were held on the Manor Hill. So as you're coming from Delavan on Highway 50, it's one of the first things you come to, and it's a nice steep hill, and it curves to the left at the bottom. And Baggy and I abided by the idea that you're not supposed to get any help from your parents. You're supposed to build this car all on your own. And that's what we did. And I can remember Howard Clemens, who was the superintendent of schools, walking by on his way to the school and seeing us working on the car and just congratulating us for abiding by the rule and doing it all on ourselves. Well, we finished the car the day before the race and didn't have a chance to try it out. And so we neither one of us wanted to drive the thing. And so what we did is we hired a driver. And our driver was Johnny Pappas. And he was also a high school classmate. And the pay was a little tin helmet. Every driver was given a little tin helmet as a protection. And so we agreed that that would be his pay if he'd drive. And the problem is we had one engineering flaw that we weren't aware of. And so here's Pappas driving down the car, and he gets to the turn, and he turns this way, and the car goes this way. And it ran into Mrs. Lennon, whose family owned the Ford garage, a large woman, and the car ran into her and knocked her ass over tea kettle. And it didn't hurt her a bit, but it was pretty exciting. And so that's our soapbox derby story. Now, I worked at National Tea, and Frank Genowack was the the manager in those days, and his brother Beano would show up, some also. And one thing that was interesting is we had to mark everything twice, what the price was and how many stamps you needed, because everything was rationed in those days. And so that was a problem. And then I remember the women would bring in grease, and they would weigh it, and how much it weighed, they'd get some additional free tickets that they could use for whatever. And then my brother Earl, after the war, stayed in Germany and became an employee of the U.S. government. And while I was working at the National Tea, I would buy Marvel cigarettes. And as you remember the earlier story, I didn't smoke them, but I sent them to Earl, and they were very valuable in Europe, and especially because they're American cigarettes, and there was a big black market deal for those cigarettes. And so Earl entered into the black market, and that won't surprise Burley at all. But anyway, he sold those cigarettes. And let's see. Oh, I mentioned one political thing. To the best of my knowledge, there were only two Democrat families in the town. One was the Pendergast, and the other one was the Douglases. And there may have been others, but those were the two that everybody knew were Democrats. And then I can remember as a kid during the war years, knitting, if you can believe this, knitting little squares for Afghans to be sent to the troops. And then I can remember the radar station halfway between here and Delavan. And the radar station was presumably to protect Milwaukee and Chicago from flying planes and that sort of thing, but also Rockford, because Rockford produced a lot of munitions, and also...
You've been listening to Tales of Lake Geneva, a program featuring recollections of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, put on last weekend by the Lake Geneva Historic Preservation Commission at the 1911 Horticultural Hall in Lake Geneva. I'm Jim McClure. Have a good afternoon.
You've been listening to Community Matters, a program that airs every Saturday morning at 11:15 on WGTD. For an online recording of today's show, log on to WGTD's website at WGTD.org, click Talk, and go to Community Matters. Your gateway to public radio is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
Supporting WGTD is the Bristol Renaissance Fair, carrying you back to 16th century England with huge turkey legs, ale, wine, fantasy, and nonstop entertainment on 13 stages and in the village streets. Online at renfair.com. Supporting WGTD is the Bristol Renaissance Fair, featuring an open-air marketplace, food, drink, and nonstop